This is the Simon Dell Show, where we take a deep dive into some of the week's most notable business and marketing stories and interview high-performing business leaders and marketing professionals to find out their lessons for success.
A lot of startup founders are great at the tech side, but not so many are good at really carving out a unique identity and a brand in the market.
Having disagreed with everything else you've said on this podcast.
It's very easy to think an idea sounds good, but then to really go out there and test it in the market.
I've agreed with Ed and Simon said something funny.
Welcome to the Simon Dell Show. It is episode 21 and it is the 27th of March 2018. Welcome to another show. We have the usual spin cycle antics with both Patrick and Ed Wiener, and we will be discussing, amongst other things, offensive adverts for people with ginger hair. So if you are one of the gingers out there, if you are a redhead and you are easily offended, then perhaps this is the spin cycle that you may want to skip. Because some not very nice things are said. But you know, I'll let you if you wanna be part of that, if you wanna hear what we've got to say, then tune into that. The big interview this week is with a gentleman by the name of Andrew Burt, who's based here in Brisbane. He is an entrepreneur, he's a product developer, and when you see some of the things he's worked on, you see some of his favorite brands, you can really understand that the guy knows how to develop products. And he is perhaps most famous for creating those LED controlled bulbs, the Wi-Fi controlled bulbs that you can buy in the Apple stores and that you can control with your phone. Now, he didn't actually invent them, but he was one of the founders of the company that invented them. That went rather large on Kickstarter, and he raised a lot of money on there. He created, he was part of the company's growth, and then exited. He's done a lot of other things. He was part of Angel Cube, which is one of Australia's first accelerator programs for startups, back when people didn't even know what the words startup actually meant. So fascinating story, fascinating guy, lots of interesting stories about how he moved through his career and how his business progressed. So definitely worth checking into. Now, before we go into the spin cycle, just the usual pieces of housekeeping. Please, if you get a chance, give us a review or rating on iTunes. We really, really appreciate that. If you are able to make any sort of donation, you'll find the cryptocurrency addresses in the show notes. And if you want to come and talk to me, please do. I'm easy to find on LinkedIn. I am easy to find on Twitter. I am Simon Dell. I think I am Simon Dell at LinkedIn as well. My Facebook page, my business Facebook page, which is Switch Your Business. You can find me there. Or if you just want to come to my website, www.simondell.com. Please come and talk to me. Please come and say hello. It's great that I get feedback from the people that listen. And if you're interested in appearing on the show, we did put a call out on LinkedIn about a month or so ago, and we got some great responses. And Andrew was actually one of those responses. But if you know somebody who's got a great story, if you've got a great story yourself in business, marketing, any of those kind of areas that you think would benefit or that people would benefit from hearing about, then please contact me, simon@simondell.com, and we'll see what we can do. Other than that, thank you very much for listening. Let's get on with the spin cycle. Once again, we're back with the spin cycle, and joining me this week, as usual, is the headmistress of co-hosts, Dr. Edwina Luck from QUT, and of course, the substitute teacher of co-hosts, Patrick Condren from Channel 7.
I was a substitute teacher this week.
Why does that not surprise me?
I got called in to lecture at the Queensland University of Technology University about political journalism.
Really? You didn't bump into Ed whilst you were there?
I did not. I think she's down at the Garden Point campus. Garden Point campus. Right. I was out at Kelvin Grove, and I was magnificent.
Really?
They have asked me back.
Really? If there's any, if any students heard Patrick speak this week, we'd love a third party opinion on how good Patrick.
I can point you to a Facebook post, a series of Facebook posts.
Really?
That indicate they were very, very taken with me.
Mm. Oh,
because I swear a bit. Nice.
Yeah, probably.
Make it real. Well, that's we're a university for the real world, so we're keeping it real.
Oh, my God. I hate that ad.
Plug in,
Oh, it's been that way for years. It's our positioning statement.
I know what your position has been for the last few years.
Under a table most of the time.
Wow.
Eddie, we're going to talk about, you're going to talk about redheads.
Redheads.
Aren't you? Because our resident redhead talking about redheads seems a sensible thing to do.
Well, I'm a pretend redhead. But, yes, so. A campaign from Carlton and United Breweries has been discontinued after the ACCC have decided that it was discriminated against red-headed people. It was a promotion for Yak Ale, and it was basically it was a very entertaining
very entertaining, yes.
And it was all about stopping the redhead gene being from spreading. But if you did actually find a rare ginger bottle label hiding in a six-pack of beer, then you could trade it in for cash prizes. So it was very clever, but the ACCC, you know, they had lots and lots of complaints. So, yeah.
What, I think the people who complained, there's a good amount of reasoning for them to be deported from Australia. I mean, come on, get a sense of humour, you like.
Bluey.
Looking for a ginger gene, I thought it was cracker. Absolutely cracker lacking. They used to call me biscuits at school.
Why did
because
they
call you? Ginger nuts, biscuits, because I was a ginger before I became a grey-haired old man. But
really?
I just
ginge,
think.
Were you?
Oh, you're very ginger tinge. Very lucky. Ginger tinge.
Maybe the grey fox blonde.
Oh.
Hmm.
Wow, you have a very fond memory. I'll have a six-pack of whatever you've been drinking, Ed, he said politely.
I just think it's
bonkers. Why? Oh, grow a sense of humour.
I know we've discussed this week in, week out about companies creating campaigns that they know are going to get themselves in trouble. They had to have known this was going to fall foul of something.
Pig's bum. It was just people making an ad that was good fun, and I guarantee you, if you went out and found and vox popped a whole bunch of gingers and showed them the ad, I mean, we've got a ginger in town tonight. That bloody Ed Sheeran bloke. He's singing up a storm. I guarantee you, he wouldn't be offended by it. Grow a sense of humour, people. It's just good fun. And while I'm speaking, I'm trying to think. There was a whole storm of controversy around the ginger a couple of years ago. I can't remember what it was. I'll have to look it up.
Good segue.
Okay.
Wow.
as a sometime redhead, Eddie, do you feel offended or?
No,
a
fake redhead. I thought it was hilarious, but I suppose if you're looking at the, you know, the ad standards community panel of the ACCC, they would get so many complaints about every ad that ever comes out. And so they have to look at their codes and their sections, and they've looked at it as a race, which includes colour, ancestry, ethnicity, and nationality. And they do go into the ad very cleverly, I must say. You know, it's in your DNA. And it's considered to be related to ancestry. So, therefore, it's considered that red hair falls within the definition of race and can be considered under Section 2.1 of the Code to be offensive. And I know that's crazy because I agree with you, Pat. I think we're really bubble-wrapping cohorts, I suppose. And you know, we've always called redheads bluey. We've always called – or ginger – or biscuit, or
red,
whatever.
Or ranger,
Fanta pants,
exactly.
Fanta pants.
But everyone has got it. I think it's a very Australian thing. But you know, Australia is so multicultural now, and a lot of people don't get the little idiosyncrasies of jokes anymore, and that's, I suppose, the sad thing. But
yes, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. Mm. Having disagreed with everything else you said on this podcast.
Well, but for 21, the last,
for 21 episodes.
For the last 327 episodes, I've finally found something that we agree on. Ranga, was it? It was a Ranga thing, and it involved that fella from the ABC. I can't remember what his name is. But, yeah, it, you know, should gingers be called Rangas and all sorts of things? But moving back to the ad, I just think it's political correctness gone mad.
Well, share that on the Instagram account. Mm. There was one I found this week was the company that set up a giant Scalextrics in Melbourne to welcome the Formula One. I just wanted to touch on that one really quickly because it was done in a business CBD. I think that's a fantastic little that wouldn't have cost much as well, because I know people who hire these things out. That was probably like $500-$600 for a couple of hours work. Just got loads of coverage everywhere.
It was fantastic. It was very,
those little things like that that you can do that have massive effect for very, very little bits of, you know, little cash input.
Yeah. For a small fee, I could have sent them some of our Scalextrics that's here, which just continues and continues to grow. You know, the doesn't match, the cars blow up and all sorts of things. But every once in a while we drag it all out. It's just good fun. It takes me back to my – I can't believe that something as, I don't know, basic has lasted as long as it has, because I can remember – playing Scalextrics. I got a third-hand Scalextrics set for Christmas one year, and we set it up, and the kids in the neighbourhood loved it. And that was when I was, you know, 10 years old. So, what, 11 years ago?
Yeah. It's a lovely nostalgic touch that I think people look at a Scalextrics set and it immediately brings back all those memories from their childhood.
Fond memories, yeah.
Don't you think you could have made it better though, Simon?
What, just make it bigger?
No.
Oh,
what, real life one, like real, you, real like you sat in no, it yourself.
Grid girls.
Well, that could have been done in shopping centres for sure. But you could have had signage, brands, you could get them involved, and it would have been even better. I mean, hopefully next year we'll be talking about this and going, oh, did you see, you know, I don't know, petrol brand and Formula One brands that I obviously don't know about and, you know. It would have
been, you such a rev head. That
yeah, that's me. Yeah, that's me.
On that note, this is the biggest story I wanted to talk about this week, which I do you know what? I honestly don't know how I feel about this, because Lynx, the we all know who Lynx are.
Golf Lynx.
No, Lynx. LYNX.
They're
the stuff you spray under your arms.
Oh, I don't do that.
Really?
No.
The Lynx effect, natural. You remember.
I do. I find it a bit offensive, and it,
no wonder no one's standing near you at press conferences.
Oh, I don't care. That suits me down to the ground.
Anyway.
moving on from my
underarms.
The former senior global brand director for Lynx, who Lynx is owned by Unilever, obviously massive, massive company, has joined an agency called BBD Perfect Storm, and they've started a new division within that agency that is tasked with focusing marketing to men. Now, I want to read you this because I swear this is not a joke, and I can't work it out. This is how I don't know whether I feel about it. It's bizarre. The unit, which is called New Macho, right, will be dedicated to identifying and capitalizing on the huge opportunity that exists for culture-changing brands and agencies to shift the narrative that currently defines what it means to be a man.
What does that mean? What does it mean? Well,
what do you reckon, Ed?
It means that gender equality, feminism, they've become a much bigger focus. So they're asking men to embrace their idiosyncrasies. Again, I've used that word tonight, but they've asking to embrace their individualism, you know, they want.
That's not clarifying it, Ed.
You've actually made it more complicated.
They want people to come up with their own ideas. It's not about brands telling them what to do. And I mean, Lynx, if you look back at the Lynx effect, you know, when there were busty models and girls in bikinis, and they, you know, times have changed, and and with the hashtag MeToo movement and all of, you know, things that are happening around the world, this is the perfect time for this, maybe the wrong new machos, you know, the wrong name, but what does it mean to be a man? Because now when I, on a side sort of angle, when I'm looking for ethics approval to conduct research, I can't ask if you're a male or a female anymore. I have to ask other. And yeah. What do you identify with? Because a lot of people...
Do you stand up to pee or do you sit down to pee?
Well, it's not really as simplistic as that when you, you know, so I think
But I still don't, you still haven't clarified
what... well, there's...
Do you, can you have a shot at it, Simon?
I'll try, I'll try and help
as, because as a punter, as a person that they would presumably be targeting because I'm a three-leg, because they would be targeting, so I don't know what... I don't know what it means.
There's another good quote here from, and this perhaps might help it a little bit, is there's the chief executive of BBD Perfect Storm, a guy called Jason Fu.
Is he a fighter?
It's kung fu fighting. But everybody was, weren't they? oh, dear.
That's the first
in
two.
In a perfect storm.
So two firsts two tonight. Things, yeah. I've agreed with Ed and Simon said something funny.
The quote is, the current mainstream masculine narrative in which men are told to man up and be tough means that it can be difficult for men to express their feelings. This is one of the major reasons why the biggest killer of men under 45 in the UK is suicide. So I guess what they're trying to do is they're trying to create new, what's the word I'm looking for? New definitions of what it is to be a man. And they're going to use those new definitions to help to sell products, essentially. So that's kind of where I get out of it.
But men are still going to buy the same things.
Not necessarily. They're going to be
spoken. So in this new age, what will I be buying that I don't have already?
See, you know who you are. Simon knows who he is. There are a lot of men and women out there who don't know who they are. And I don't mean, you know, my name's so-and-so. But it means that it celebrates diversity, and it means that you can make up your own mind, which, okay, some people haven't been allowed to because of the way that maybe society sees them, or that if they do something, they're going to be ridiculed. And for you, Pat, it's okay because you know you're confident, you do whatever you want. You're over 45, so therefore, you know,
Hang on a second.
Okay, you're over 55. Oh, sorry, no.
Wow.
I think, at the end of the day, I like the sentiment behind it because I like the idea that they're trying to say to, you know, men. And I had this conversation a couple of episodes ago with Rachel, who I interviewed, and she said the same thing, is that, you know, a lot of men, certainly men in higher up in business, don't have anyone to talk to. They can't discuss things. And subsequently, you know, that often ends up in a, you know, fairly disastrous, you know, ending.
Are men heading the way that women have had to live in a male-dominated world for so long?
I don't think so. Do you mean it's like all going to flip on its head?
Yes. And men are now going to, I'm not suggesting for a second that we are anywhere near, you know, the opposite of a male-dominated world, not in any way, shape or form. But is that the direction it's heading in, and these guys are just trying to get ahead of the curve? Or are they just marketing wankers who are making up things to sell us that we don't need?
No, I think it's a really nice attitude and an attitude change and an acceptance of differences because I think men have
been... But what products are they trying to sell us? That's what I don't understand.
It's not about that. It's not a product. It's actually a way of thinking.
So to my way of thinking, to pick up that point, Ed, what'd she say?
What?
What did you say? Are you blokes having a conversation without me?
No. Go on, keep talking.
It's BCF. It's Tent World. It's, you know, you go in and you buy something that you want because you want it. Most of the men I know aren't, you know, they're not into manscaping. They're not, you know, peace, love, mung bean sort of people. So they would have the same reaction to that, to what Simon has read out so far, in terms of what bullshit.
I think the point, there was an interesting video shared this week, and I don't mean this in a condescending way, but it was the lead singer of Linkin Park. Does either of you know who Linkin Park?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
So Chester Bennington, he killed himself last year. And his wife this week shared a video of him. I think it was literally 2 or 3 hours before he committed suicide. Wow. And he was in that same way that Pat mentions, like, you know, blokes having a laugh. He was laughing hard. They were doing something like tasting strange jelly bean flavors, and they videoed it all. And it was hours before he killed himself, and you couldn't tell. And I think what this agency are trying to do here is to sit there and say that generic perception of a man who's, you know, and Chester Bennington was, like, you know, classic rock god, tattoos, that kind of thing. You know, tough guy. Yeah, that is not. That might be who we all think we are, or who all men think they are, but that's not who all men actually are. And
yeah, that makes sense.
And what they want to do is try and identify better ways of communicating with some of those people who struggle to communicate, who are just going along with the group, as it were. That's what I get from it. Yeah, I like the sentiment.
That makes sense.
The only other thing I would add to that is that I do feel, however, that in 2018, they're probably about 5 years behind where they should have been.
Possibly, yeah. Because
I would have thought that this is the sort of thing that should have been done
a long time ago. When metrosexual was the big word, when was that? Was that 10 years ago even? I'm trying to remember that.
I've never been a cracksacking back man, so I don't know.
No, but it wasn't just about that. It was about a way of life. It's a way of acceptance, and there's a lot of change that's got to happen, and there's a lot of conversations that have got to happen. And hopefully, you know, if you're listening to this, Simon, you'll put up some of these articles, because they really are. They're very interesting and thought-provoking.
Guys, it's been been deep and meaningful today, hasn't
it? It has.
You know, it's not been
apart from my bit, obviously.
Well, yeah, yours was. Wow. Yours was.
There was a bit there, Pat. It's
okay. Oh, thanks, Ed.
Yeah, that's right.
Anyway, thank you both very much, and we'll talk to you next week.
See
you. Bye, boys. Bye.
I'm lucky enough to be joined by Andrew Burt today. He is based here in Brisbane, like me. Now, he's got a pretty long CV, so I'm just going to pick up some of the highlights. He's currently the founder of a company called GoSave. We'll hear about that a little bit later. He's also the founder of Mosaic Labs. He's been the CMO of Clinicloud. He's been the founder and CMO of Lifex? How do you say that? Lifex. That's right. Okay. He's the founder and MD, or was the founder and MD of Angel Cube down in Melbourne, the managing partner of Startup Marketing, all sorts of other bits and pieces. So welcome to the show, Andrew.
Yeah, thanks very much, Simon.
And recently a dad for the second time 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, exactly. So, luckily she's a pretty good sleeper this time, so I feel pretty good.
Okay. Is it bringing back all those horrible memories from the previous one that you...
It's funny. It's amazing how much you forget. It's like we're doing it all again for the first time. It's a lot of fun.
First question. It's the same question I ask everybody. What was your first job? When did you first get actually paid money to do something?
Like outside of, say, a school job or
anything? No, anything. Mine was delivering newspapers, the horrible job that was. But what did you do?
Yeah, a lot of entrepreneurs seem to have this really good origin story of, you know, they collected golf balls and sold them.
Yes.
My first ever job was basically stocking shelves at Target.
Right. Okay.
So I think I was about 15, and Dad said, a lot of my friends actually worked in fast foods, at McDonald's or KFC, and Dad wanted me to do the same thing. I wasn't too keen on that idea, but Target wasn't a bad compromise, so I kind of used to walk around and stuff.
What put you off the fast food?
I don't know. I didn't like the idea of standing there a deep fryer for hours on end. I think probably pretty clumsy at the best of times. So probably would have been a workplace accident waiting to happen.
Right. Okay. That was personal safety was paramount at that point.
Yeah. Exactly.
I'm just going to kind of get a bit of an overview because obviously we've sort of had a few emails and backwards and forwards. Your profile basically is littered with what looks like you creating things. Would that be a fair assumption? I don't generalize about everything you've done, but it seems that you've created a lot of things.
Yeah, that's probably a fairly good summary. I guess throughout my career, I've been good at starting things, and I think in the later part of my career, I want to get better at finishing things
because right.
it's a really interesting thing for people who are entrepreneurial. Starting things is definitely a challenge, but yeah. The really successful entrepreneurs kind of go on to really stick at a particular project for a number of years, turn into a big company. I haven't necessarily been able to do that just yet. But I'm kind of hoping my latest project, GoSave, want to tie up a heap of the learnings from previous projects and hopefully really make this one a long-term one that we can build into a big company.
What was it in your when did you first sit there and go that you realized you kind of wanted to make things or create things? What was there? Was there some sort of triggering moment that wasn't stacking a shelf in Target that you suddenly went, you know what, I'm pretty good at creating these things or coming up with these ideas?
Yeah, I guess my first like professional job after uni was working for RMIT University, so they've actually got a commercialization and commercial offshoot down there in Melbourne called RMIT Training. I worked in like a business development role there for a few years and we used to commercialize new products internally. So I kind of always used to gravitate to those new products and was always keen on what was going on and wanted to help people build things. And we had this awesome product development guy called Lucky Sedaris who I used to really look up to.
That's a good name.
Great name, isn't it? Lucky. L-A-K-I rather than L-U-C-K-Y. But so I was always fascinated by what Lucky did, and he was so innovative and always had new ideas and just seemed to be able to pull them out of nowhere, so to speak. So I kind of always enjoyed working with him, and then I think him and I got along really well, and the more and more we talked, I think I had this natural creative streak anyway. My dad's an artist and then became a lecturer in fine arts. So I guess he's the real creative.
Yeah.
I think I've definitely got that innate sense to want to build things and make things. And that's kind of how I describe myself in some respects too. I'm kind of a marketer turned maker.
Right.
Kind of most of my professional career has been marketing. But now, particularly after LifeX and now GoSave, I kind of came up with the idea, sketched the initial designs, prototyped it all, done a lot of the development in-house with one other business partner, and this is probably the first project I've actually gone through the full life cycle as a maker. So kind of starting to see myself a bit differently in terms of my career going forward.
What back in those days of the RMIT, was there something that you sort of think back and remember fondly that you created or at least you worked on with other people that was created?
Lucky and my boss at the time, Paul, created this really good product called TV News. It sounds a bit kind of archaic nowadays, but say this is 10 years ago. And they found out through a bunch of research that they did that every single library in Australia, particularly every university library, has the ability to record things off TV. They're legally allowed to do it because they can show it in class. And they pay a big licensing fee to do that, to Copyright and Licensing Australia. So the RMIT guys basically determined that, okay, the universities are paying this fee, they're allowed to record things and show them to their students, but they never do. So we, at RMIT, we actually started taping all of this TV news content and archiving it and then making that searchable. So lecturers could, say, type in any particular topic, maybe it's a marketing subject, and then pull that up and show the students. And they could do that entirely within their licensing conditions. And we just productized that for them. So we used to charge, $30,000 annual subscription for that or even more. And Lucky kind of came up with that idea just over beers with a number of the team members one day, and then it turned into kind of a million dollar product for wow. the actual business. So
yeah,
so it was one of the first commercializations of a new product that I'd seen up close and personal.
When you look at those kind of products back in those days, and your next role after that was actually in a marketing company. What are some of the things that you saw the businesses do? Let's start with badly. Those new product businesses, those startup businesses. What did you generally find that they did badly back then?
It's a good question. I kind of went into I created my own marketing consultancy because I was very interested in helping startups. But I think at that point, my skill set was entirely marketing. So I didn't really have the ability. I'm not a developer by trade. Didn't really know how to make any products. Was interested in new ideas, but didn't really see myself as the ideas person at that point. And so I thought a marketing company would be really interesting because obviously that's my skill set and I'm interested in helping new ideas grow. And so I basically set up shop as a marketing consultancy and, yeah, started working with different entrepreneurs of all kinds, really, before moving and eventually specializing in technology. But yeah, in terms of mistakes, I think it's the classic things, and we all do it. I think people are getting too grandiose, so people thinking they could take over the world overnight and on a shoestring budget. I think probably people not thinking through their product market fit as well. It's very easy to think an idea sounds good, but then to really go out there and test it in the market and make sure it's people actually want what you're building is super important. So I think that's a really easy mistake to make as an entrepreneur, that kind of confirmation bias that we all get when we come up with an idea and we think it's good. Always good to stress test it. And then being under-resourced, I think, was the big challenge. So when we first started the marketing consultancy, people used to say, oh, startups have got no money. How are you guys going to make any money by providing consulting fees? And it's not a great model to provide consulting fees to startups.
People that don't have any money, yes.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. Yes. And so that kind of led me on to my next company as well, which was a different model, which was AngelCube.
How did you ever manage to overcome that? Because that's a challenge that I've had, and a colleague I work with now is having, that these startups often need expert advice but can't pay for expert advice. They sometimes need the expert advice, but they need the lower paid implementation, if that makes sense.
Yeah, exactly. It's a really tough one too, because you want to help the startup as much as you can. Like some service providers, and particularly I'm talking 10 years ago, the web development companies used to be quite predatory. I remember we had a client that was paying $100,000 to build their website. it wasn't a complex piece of software. It was really almost a LinkedIn clone, so to speak. So they really shouldn't have been paying anywhere near that.
Yeah, I've seen when startups go to creative agencies, and the creative agency says what you need is a big idea to launch your product onto the, into the marketplace, when that's desperately what they don't need.
Exactly.
And I've had a previous guest has said that that's one of the problems with marketing agencies, is they sell what they want to sell. They don't necessarily sell what the client actually needs, irrespective of whether it's a startup or a multi-million dollar business.
Yeah, that's so true. And I found that as a marketing consultancy myself. Like I used to struggle with that. And I think I've kind of always had this problem of being too honest. And so to the detriment of my marketing company, I was always talking potential customers out of spending too much with us.
Yeah, that's not a good idea.
Yeah. But I kind of, that whole thing where you know that they shouldn't be spending that.
Yeah.
I always prefer to be much more direct with them.
Yeah.
In terms of like building a sustainable consulting company, it's funny. I do quite a bit of consulting nowadays as really just a side project and to keep me fresh and keep me interested in different things. But I found that kind of moving to a retainer model works really well. So I used to do startup marketing. We used to do project by project work. But nowadays, usually I work with pretty well-funded startups that have usually either got seed or series A or they're self-funded, but
yeah,
but to a fairly significant amount. And then usually just kind of work with them on capacity where I say, all right, let's track a retainer in place that's less than what they'd be paying for a full-time staff member.
Yeah.
But and it gives me the ability to kind of come in a day a week or less. And I think I can add a lot of value, but not necessarily being full-time part of the business, just kind of helping them get from where they need to go and not always for a long period of time either. It might be 12 months and then they can hire a full-time kind of CMO from there.
Yeah. I've been sort of trying to move to that model. Well, I'm moving to that model sort of in the last 12 months and building a team behind me that I can say to a client, well, you could spend, $5,000 a month on a marketing executive, or you can spend less on having a team of marketing advisors who can come in your business and help you every month. And most people see the benefit of that. You know, you still get pushback where people go, we want someone in the business. And we joking in the last podcast about people who recruit, the famous is marketing stroke admin people. And, you know, because you only ever get one of those two, you never get both. You either get an admin person or you get a marketing person. One part of that job description tends to fail. So,
yeah.
Trying to build that retainer model is tough. How do you sell that? What's the sort of, when you're going out talking consulting, what sort of language, what sort of ideas are you saying to people why they should have someone in one day a week rather than a full-time person?
Yeah. It's funny, to be honest, I don't really go out there and seek that kind of work. I've found over the years that it tends to come to me just based on, I guess, projects that I've been involved with in the past, particularly, I guess, my experience with hardware. So I've probably worked with about eight hardware companies now over the last few years. And it's probably mainly from the experience from LifeX. So I think we kind of turned LifeX into a reasonably decent success story. I left sooner than what I would like to, but we can talk about that as well. But so I think it's people that have seen what we did at LifeX and then ended up seeking me out and saying, we're building something similar, or, we want to take this particular product to retail. And so often it's been just leveraging that experience that we gained through that particular product, whether it's launching it on Kickstarter or raising Series A or setting up retail and distribution channels. I've ended up doing that at LifeX, but then repeating that with a number of other companies since.
Before we talk about LifeX, I just want to sort of touch on Angel Cube, because you highlight that it was one of Australia's first accelerator programs. What took you to that from a marketing company? What was the thought pattern in that sort of step?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I really liked the model. So I think I was struggling with having the marketing consultancy and that reluctance to, I send people a fee proposal and then work on project-based work that I was talking about earlier. And I remember I picked up, I used to go to Borders all the time and read the magazines. This is showing my age, because I don't think Borders even exists anymore. It certainly doesn't in Australia anyway. But I used to go and just browse the magazines all the time, and I think it was the cover of Inc. or Fortune had Paul Graham from Y Combinator on one of the covers. And I remember kind of leafing through that and reading about Y Combinator. And it was probably in its second class at the time. So I think this is, say, 2007. I might not have the dates exact there. But I was reading about this model that this guy was actually giving startups, and we all know the model now, but, $18,000 at the time, and taking a small percentage of their business and giving them mentorship and creating a pool of experts. So I just read that. I thought, wow, that's so much better than my consulting company. That's a really superior model. And it really kind of stayed with me for about a year. I used to think about it. I wrote business plans. I talked to the Techstars guys early on about potentially bringing it to Australia. It was years before they eventually did. They didn't want to bring it to Australia at the time either. They, you know, I think they were pretty early in their life cycle as well. So I kind of had that interest in doing it. And then it was funny. We had an approach from a particular client who had this idea for a web, basically an online contest app. A wealthy guy, good entrepreneur, had sold his previous company, approached our marketing company about building this online contest software. And he said to me, you know, what do you think of the idea? And I heard him out for about an hour or so, and probably, again, the honesty factor. You know, he's sitting there excited, really wealthy guy. He said, do you like this idea? I said, to be honest, I don't. I think it's a shocker. I just wasn't interested in it at all.
Yeah.
Couldn't see the merit in it. Smart guy, but an older guy. And sometimes, I think we don't see it as much now, but I think we used to see people like pitch technical ideas that couldn't necessarily be built. I think all of us have a better understanding now of what can and can't be built. But, in 2010, that might not have been as much. So, and it was funny. I thought, oh, this is going to be the end of that relationship. But to his credit, he said to me, well, what would you do if you had $100,000 to spend on a new product? Because I'm more interested in working with you than necessarily working on this particular software. Because we'd been in a few conversations, so we'd built up a relationship by that point in time. And then I mentioned what I'd read about Y Combinator and how I'd talked to Techstars and what I was interested in there. And he loved the idea as well. So he got it instantly and really liked it and went away and did his own homework and came back and said, right, I'm going to put the first $100,000 in. Let's write a business plan and go and show that to other people and see who else likes it too. So that's what we ended up doing. We put the Angel Cube business plan, or I guess the IM, together, shopped that around over a period of 3 or 4 months, and eventually raised just under $1 million to launch that accelerator in 2011.
What did you do to get that name out there? Because obviously those accelerator programs, early days of those in Australia, how did you build awareness of that?
Yeah, it's funny. I've been asked that question a lot over the years, and the answer is pretty simple. It's if you're giving away money, and no one was at the time, people will beat a path to your door. So there's only Startmate that existed before that, and then we came along. And the VC scene in Australia was pretty nascent at that stage. It's matured a lot recently, like some amazing funds now. But, there wasn't many early-stage technology funds back in 2011. And so we did a meetup. I used to run this meetup group called the Lean Startup Melbourne. And we had about 700 or 800 members in that group. And, yeah, we did an event specifically around Angel Cube to that group. And it was completely full. There was, say, 200 people there in the room all had come along to hear about it and what we planned to do. And then we got quite a bit of press and a lot of inbound interest through just email and social media. And I think we had 150, 160 applicants in that first year. It was,
wow.
It really wasn't a huge challenge to get that kind of deal flow. Not that I really like that word deal flow, but.
No, but we know what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But I'd imagine it's harder now. Like, there's a lot of accelerators now. So, in those days, it was a hell of a lot easier.
It's one of those stories, when you look at the time that you did that, which is, what, 2010 to 2012, that echoes other stories that people have told on this podcast, that sort of time from around about 2008 through to 2012, 2013, those sort of 5-year block there was when there was the early days of things like the smartphones, the iPhones, early days of Facebook, Twitter, etc., etc. And some people have said that back in that day, if you just did the basics right, if you just produced good content, if you just had a lot of people following you on Facebook, you could pretty much achieve anything. It was just that it was those channels were in such early stage that anybody doing something right on those channels was kind of scoring goals easily.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? Yeah, I mean, yeah, the startup market was tiny in those days. Like I remember I used to tell people I work in startups or with startups, and people would always say, well, what are startups? So whereas nowadays we've got the, kind of the Turnbull government was banging the drum as the innovation agenda, and it's a really kind of well-known word now and very mainstream. So, and that I never really predicted that. I just kind of gravitated to it because I was interested in it, and I found it cool. And who kind of knew it was going to get as big as it has? But I guess the amount of wealth that's been created by, as you say, like the smartphone and all the apps and the opportunities that's opened, it's just drawn so many people in.
So LifeX then, it says founder and CMO. So talk to me about the founder bit first. How much of a founder were you? Was it all your idea? Was it a group of people? How did it happen?
Yeah, it's a funny origin story, LifeX, because it was really a bit of a side project between Phil Boshua was the inventor. He came up with the idea and he was the real instigator. So there's actually nine LifeX co-founders. It's funny to say. I'll kind of explain the story. But if you were to point someone and say that was the LifeX founder, you'd point to Phil because he really came up with the idea himself, kind of drew the idea on the back of a napkin and started pulling the team together. And the strange thing was, so he was going through AngelCube at the same time he came up with the idea for LifeX. So Nikki Skavak from Blackbird actually introduced me to Phil initially and said, look, this guy applied to StartMate, really smart, had a million ideas. He didn't come into StartMate. We weren't sure which idea he wanted to do, but he's worth chatting to if you want to interview someone for your Melbourne cohort. So this was our second cohort in 2012. And so I sat down with Phil, and sure enough, Nikki was right. Phil had a million and one ideas, and not necessarily all of them were good, but we brought him into the AngelCube program just because he's such a creative force. And him and I worked really well together, got along really well, and I think there was a bit of a good dynamic between us. I was kind of the straight man to his kind of crazy, inventive type, and so we hit it off really well in that regard. And then when he was going through AngelCube with a different idea, and when he said to me, oh, Bertie, I've got another idea for a Wi-Fi light bulb. Do you want to work on it together? And I thought, gee, that's a really good idea. And it's very rare. Like, you know, I'd been working in and around startups for maybe 7 or 8 years.
Yeah.
That long? No, maybe about 4 or 5 years by that point. And that idea's floored me. I hadn't really been floored by an idea so quickly like that. So it was almost one of those drop everything moments and just let's just work on this. And so him, myself, and Guy King and a few others kind of worked around a really solid block for about 3 months, and Andy Gelmi and a few others as well, building the prototype. And Phil and I did all the business stuff. So we wrote the Kickstarter script. We shot that. We filmed that. We edited that and really kind of planned the Kickstarter campaign with a couple of others as well, while Andy and Phil's dad and a few others built the prototype. So it was this really interesting, and this is why we end up with so many founders, because we had the business team and the tech team really early on, which is kind of rare in a startup. But it worked for us in the respect that we had a decent sized team that could actually pull that off, and we ended up successfully delivering. But kind of long story short, having so many founders at the early stages, it was always factions and
politics. I was going to say it must have been, I mean, if you're saying there's nine founders, there's equity, 100% equity split nine ways, I can imagine that was a challenge.
Yeah, definitely. And it was all different amounts as well. So Phil obviously had the largest holding, and I had the second largest. And so I think that probably bred a lot of like infighting and jealousy. And not that many people would admit that now, I don't think, but I think naturally, particularly when things are going well, there's a lot of money on the table because we sold nearly $10 million worth of product in our first 12 months. So we did $1.3 million on Kickstarter and then a bunch in pre-sales and distribution shortly after. So, I think if we had got the cap table better positioned and made sure people were more comfortable with their holdings earlier on, I think it would have been more harmonious because it was – our culture wasn't great. So I think it's pretty good nowadays. They've got a pretty good team now and the business is kind of thriving. But
I want to take a step back there. When you did the Kickstarter campaign, because that's one of those things that, I mean, I've tried it wasn't a Kickstarter campaign. I can't remember what I tried, but it was a while ago. I think a lot of people like the idea of doing Kickstarter campaigns and then suddenly go, well, how do I actually get people, how do I draw attention to this product on Kickstarter? I think a lot of people assume that once you put it on Kickstarter, Kickstarter is going to do the work for you. And that just by being on Kickstarter, hundreds of thousands of people are going to get to see it and that solves all your problems. But it's not quite like that, is it?
Not now, but it's similar to the point you raised earlier about getting in early. So
it was back then, you think?
Yeah, it's funny. 2012, our marketing campaign for LifeX wasn't very sophisticated and it didn't even kick in because we got everything ready and we put a lot of effort into the video and the page and getting all the design looking as good as we could. So we thought we had a good story. And we launched, and it did something like 250,000 on the first day.
Wow.
Another 500,000 on the next day, and then another 600 or 700 on the following day.
What were you thinking when you saw those numbers coming in?
It was kind of surreal, to be honest. And to make matters even stranger, we were in New York at the time. Angel Cube, we were basically taking all our startups around we did our US trip at the end of the year, went to San Francisco, then went to New York. And we launched this Kickstarter as a side project. Just Phil and I obviously pulled the trigger and we were in the US just thinking, oh, this will be fun, and we'll see how it goes. We just didn't know what to think. It was a really surreal feeling just to watch the numbers continue to go up and people congratulating us on social media, and Phil was on the front page of The Age one day, and then I had a big write-up in the Sydney Morning Herald a few days later. And I think I was probably 28 or 29 at the time, and I think naively I thought, oh yeah, we've made it, this is
I'm rich.
That kind of mentality probably kicked in for the team too early, so it was a lot of fun.
And you mentioned that ended earlier than you wanted it to end, or ended earlier than it should have ended. Dare I ask how and why?
I'm kind of an open book with this stuff. When I was mentioning earlier, we probably because we didn't have the team dynamics set really well in place early on, and so there was naturally always a bit of conflict, bit of infighting as we went along. And I was with the company for about 2 years, and Phil and I were really always kind of, particularly usually the front people, yes, we had 9 founders, but often they'd do a write-up and they'd say the founders, Phil and Andrew, blah, blah, blah. And we'd do all the VC meetings together and a lot of the press together and things like that. So him and I had a really particularly intense relationship because we were just always, traveling together on the road together. And both pretty headstrong. And so we just kind of the relationship towards the end of 2 years, just kind of naturally fraying a bit, just kind of at each other about silly things that we shouldn't have necessarily been. And we should have been able to, if we had a board where it was just him and I with a board, we would have kind of reached this loggerheads moment. And I think we would have been big enough to kind of, give each other credit and then talk our positions around. But we had a third board member. So long story short, and I hope Phil doesn't mind me retelling this. We've since actually made up. We're good friends again, so which is great. But basically him and I fell out about a particular, stressful circumstance around the business, about mainly around cash flow type stuff.
Yeah.
And we got home from a particular trip. He worded up this board member who kind of, you would think would be neutral, but it was really a 2-on-1 situation. So I got home the day later, fronting up to the board meeting, and it was kind of them against me type scenario. Yeah. It wasn't particularly fun, but I had some points as well. I was pretty hot-headed and, I could have handled some things better, and I could have been more diplomatic about the way I tried to rein in the spending and things like that. But but you get older and wiser in business and you learn these things over time. I kind of So I ended up resigning, but there would have been ways and means to fire me. So I got out trying to preserve the relationship as well as I could at that point, which didn't necessarily eventuate, but patched up things with most of the team since. But then it's funny, then Phil left 6 months later, so on his own kind of acrimonious split as well. So the whole company was a bit of a revolving door at one point, but the new leadership kind of stabilised it, and they've had a very solid team in place for a number of years now.
You still own a share of it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so I still have a reasonable size position in on the cap table, and so does Phil and a number of other people. But so hopefully, all going well, it really should be a $200-300 million company. Like, it's the revenues are really high. It's probably number two in its category globally. Really deep integrations, good retail distribution.
Is that the one that you see available in Apple stores, or is that a competitor?
Yeah, no, it is. We're an Apple right throughout the US.
Right, okay.
So you can walk into any Apple store and pick up a LifeX in the US. But Philips Hue is also there, so they're our main rival.
Yeah.
In Australia, I don't think they carry LifeX at Apple.
Okay. The problem with you is there's about 1,000 questions I could ask you here, and generally people sort of switch off after about an hour of me and you talking. But so I'm just trying to get to the juicy bits, the interesting bits. And I want to touch on Clinicloud, because you were the CMO there. You weren't a founder. That wasn't your idea or anything like that.
No, exactly.
Was that just a job opportunity that you saw in the classified ads, or did someone approach you or something like that?
It's a good question though. So when I was leave, because I didn't really expect to leave LifeX, and particularly so suddenly, I kind of, everything was going brilliantly in December 2013, and then by January 2014 it wasn't so good, and then I left early Feb. So it was a really kind of unexpected departure, and that classic moment where you scratch your head and you think, gee, what am I going to do now?
Yeah.
And I had a little bit of money behind me by that point, but not a hell of a lot. And so I really had to either determine whether I wanted to found another company or take a job. And I started off by doing a bunch of consulting. So, I was working with a few other kind of product-related companies, and Clinicloud was one of them. So they were a client, and we all got along really well. There's two great founders, both doctors, met at university, at med school. One of them came up with the idea, the other one was the business guy. But they didn't have a lot of marketing experience, and I guess I had a lot of retail and go-to-market kind of relationships that we needed. And so the more and more I worked with them, I thought, because my consulting, I was kind of thinking I was treading water. I didn't want to continue to do consulting solely forever. But the more and more I talked to the guys, I just kind of thought, this is I really like the mission behind what we were doing, because the stethoscope, kind of to cut a long story short, the original vision of the Clinicloud stethoscope was to be able to auto-detect pneumonia. So in theory, we could give that to someone, a doctor in a regional village in Kenya, for example. They could detect if someone had pneumonia or not, which would mean, they could actually intervene and save that person's life. So I like the combination of tech, the team, and the mission. And the more and more I thought about it, I kind of thought, I couldn't stop thinking about that particular idea. So rather than found something, I joined as the CMO. I was kind of, essentially, I was almost like a founder in a lot of respects, because it wasn't necessarily a job. And, the guys were like, do you want to be a founder? But they had such a great story already. The two doctors met at med school, and this one guy who founded a lighting company. Like, it was a better story as the two of them. And I think my LifeX experience was the less founders, the better. And I kind of used to enjoy just, if they had to sort something out, they did a really good job of sorting it out between themselves.
Let them punch on in a room somewhere when you don't get involved. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, doctors are pretty intelligent, pretty diplomatic. So there's no punch ons. intellectual punch ons. They're both intelligent guys.
Talk to me about. I want to touch at this point about actual marketing, because what are you? When you see other businesses, when you see startups, when you, you know, go into your local retail stores and things like that, what are some of the principles of marketing for you that you sort of focus on every time or think are really important for businesses to focus on?
Yeah, I'm a real branding guy. So I kind of always, I see myself as much more a strategic marketer than a tactical marketer. So the big things I like to zone in on are branding, because if you can get your brand strategy right and your positioning in the market, and you know your value proposition, and you can really articulate that clearly, you're head and shoulders above so many other businesses and so many other startups as well, because a lot of startup founders are great at the tech side, but not so many are good at really carving out a unique identity and a brand in the market. So that's usually like where I like to start. And then I love kind of getting into the positioning and strangely copywriting. So I think copywriting is like an underrated part of startups, because if you can write really good copy on your website and on your packaging and your other materials, that just kind of leaps off the page and succinctly and clearly talks about what you're doing, you kind of get to hold people's attention. There's not kind of no point getting a ton of PR and press and everything like that and having bad messaging. So I really like to, yeah, get branding, positioning, value prop, strategy, and that messaging right early on. And then if you do and that tests well, then kind of growth starts to happen. And then you can always accelerate that growth through ways and means. But
on Clinicloud, obviously that's a fairly challenging target market, doctors, because, you know, they're sometimes perhaps less responsive to sales and marketing messages than some other people are. Not that I know many doctors, but that's kind of the impression I get. Would that be the case, that they're a little bit of a harder ask to sell to?
Yeah, I mean, we were targeting consumers predominantly.
Right,
so
okay.
Our kind of strapline was bringing healthcare home, which worked really well for the investment market. Like we ended up raising $5 million inbound for that business, partly, you know, off the tech, but also I think on our positioning. I think it played a big role. So we were kind of had that promise to consumers, bringing healthcare home. When we were targeting doctors, it was fascinating. They fell into two really different camps. You had the really early adopter type doctor, which was, honestly, they were almost like a 50-50 split. There was the kind of the younger, tech-savvy doctors who just loved the product and really liked what we were doing. And then we had kind of the more, I shouldn't necessarily divide them in age, but we had kind of the tech-savvy doctor and the not-so-tech-savvy doctor. And they were, and the not-so-tech-savvy doctor was always skeptical of,
yeah,
not just us, but, yeah, of kind of any new tech that goes into the doctor's office that they don't even like EMRs and things like that that they have to use by law in the US. So, yeah, really, really interesting kind of the two camps of different types of physicians that we dealt with. And it wasn't a big deal, because if people weren't interested in us, it becomes self-selecting. They just didn't talk to us. But
yeah.
So yeah, for years we were having great conversations with doctors who were really fascinated by what we were doing.
I want to sort of move on to some of the stuff you're doing at the moment. And we'll pretty touch on GoSave last. But I want to talk to you about the Internet of Things, because that seems to be another sort of prevalent theme in your career. We've heard a lot about the Internet of Things in the past probably 3 or 4 years, but it doesn't feel that we've perhaps got anywhere. Do you think that's the case, or am I missing it?
Well, it's funny, yeah. I didn't even know the term Internet of Things until we started doing LifeX. So we thought it was a cool product and, you know, connected to the smartphone. And then we got invited to speak at a conference called Le Web, and they said, oh, this year's theme is the Internet of Things. And we kind of had to Google it and look it up on Wikipedia to work out what it was. I like to think the broad umbrella term Internet of Things is really challenging, because there's so many sub-disciplines within the Internet of Things that you can look at. But So I like to break it up into particular categories. And then, so LifeX, for example, we're in the smart home category. Essentially all the products, you know, like Alexa and Google Home and Ring and any other smart lights or door locks or garage door openers all kind of fit under that smart home category. And it's a big market, but it probably, you know, it's like the early majority stage at the moment. I wouldn't say it's a mass market yet, but there's been a few billion-dollar acquisitions in that space. Obviously, we had Nest, and then Ring.com got bought by Amazon recently. So, yeah, there's still a lot of opportunity in that market. But then you look at different subsectors of IoT, like ag tech's a really big market. You look at kind of energy as another one. There's a lot of smart energy companies doing some really interesting things. So, I think IoT is definitely booming within particular categories, but the broad umbrella term IoT is almost like saying internet. It's just such a generic term that it's not particularly informative. So
I think what sort of I find challenging is that, you know, 3, 4, 5 years ago, people said, oh, you know, we're going to have connected fridges, and, you know, the fridge is going to know when you're out of eggs and milk and all those kind of things, and it's going to order it for you and blah, 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 blah. And everyone went, oh, yeah, that's great. And everyone sort of went, do I really need a connected fridge? And connected washing machines. I could turn a washing machine on when I'm at work, or the dishwasher on, all those kind of things. And don't get me wrong, I am as tech friendly as the next person, but I think there's a point now where people are going, is it tech for the sake of tech versus is it actually going to make a difference or a discernible difference to my life? And I think fridges fall into that it's tech for the sake of tech thing.
Oh, totally. Absolutely. We used to think that with LifeX too. It was probably through more good luck than good planning, but lights are one of the parts of IoT that are actually quite helpful. So, you know, yes, it's a bit of a gimmick to kind of turn the light on and off from your phone, but the voice control with things like Alexa and Google Home, being able to change the colors of the lights, and then a lot of people, we had customers that were mobility impaired, so were in wheelchairs and couldn't reach switches and things like that. So there's these big kind of subsectors out there that get a lot of value from IoT. So lighting's one of the ones. Security's another one that IoT's been really has done a good job. So Ring.com's been massively successful for that reason, because they've kind of created this mesh network of almost like the old neighborhood watch program, but brought into the 21st century. So, yeah, there's IoT just for the sake of connecting something to the internet. Yeah, not a good thing. But if that IoT capability like brings a new capability to the product that's really valuable and customers like, then I think you're using it in the correct way. So, and there's a lot of companies that we don't even necessarily think of as IoT as well, like a lot of these bike sharing companies and things like that have distributed bikes all around the place. That, you know, they are IoT companies when you think about it. But again, they're kind of, you know, it's an interesting space that in itself, and it's got its own challenges, but pretty massive market in some respects. So
where do you sit on that? Where do you sit on blockchain and its kind of its usefulness with IoT? Are you a blockchain fan, or are you a naysayer?
We could be here all day. it's like intellectually, it's super interesting. It's really easy to look at all the ICOs and see the crazy amount of money being raised, and it's easy to turn an eyebrow off of that and think it's all a fad and a scam, and you know, the massive rise of Bitcoin and the incredible prices, and it was just eye-watering. 2017 was unbelievable.
Yeah.
And it's obviously, you know, the market's cooled a bit this year, and I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I think blockchain in and of itself, like we're at the super nascent stages, so it's almost like the internet in 1994. It's kind of tipping into this mainstream area, but there's a lot of performance issues, so there's so much that people promise you can do with a blockchain that you just can't do yet. So Yeah, long term, I'm really bullish on it because I just think there's so many. I really like the smart contract concept and this idea of being able to facilitate, and this is in IoT, being able to facilitate transactions without a person involved. I think that's really interesting. But the use cases for blockchain, we could almost be here all day. There's nearly every startup that I talk to nowadays, they'll ask me, could we use blockchain in our model? And the answer is for a lot of them, yes. Obviously, you don't want to do it. But a SQL database will do most of the things that people want to do with it. So a lot of them are kind of doing it cynically with the view of raising money. But I think if you look at the actual technology itself and you want to build something interesting and create a decentralized service, then, yeah, I think we're going to be amazed by the things that people come out with in the next 10 years.
I kind of feel blockchain has the same trouble as Internet of Things in the fact that there's certain things that probably don't need to be on the Internet of Things, and there's certain things that don't necessarily need to be on blockchain. But because it was a fad, or is it exciting new technology that people are just gravitate towards that because it's an easy buck or it's an easy way to raise money and all those kind of things. So, you know, I think it'll settle down gradually over the next 2 or 3 years. And I think all blockchain really needs is a killer app, is a use case that everyone suddenly goes, oh, that's it, that's the one we were all looking for. And I think then it cascades from there, you know. But I don't think anyone sat there and looked at a perfect example of a blockchain technology that everybody uses day in, day out, and gone, this I understand. It's still such early days for a lot of them.
Yeah, exactly. It's it's a really interesting comparison actually between the two. I remember there was a meme that used to go around, you know, saying connect all the things, and that was the early days of IoT was exactly like that. It was just cool, you know, as you say, connecting the fridge, but without any thought or regard for why. But yeah, it's kind of blockchain all the things now. But yeah, I think there's going to be a lot of kind of ones that will crash and burn, but there'll be some interesting use cases that will be around long term that will emerge. I think smart contracts are that killer use case, and obviously it's a big part of Ethereum and a number of others as well. But I think the ICO in and of itself, regardless of all its problems with, you know, securities laws and jurisdictions and utility versus versus security tokens, so there's a lot of grey area in that. But the actual smart contract itself, you're writing a piece of code that can be representational of equity or you know, creating a will or executing a will or all these kinds of things. That I think the legal profession is one of the ones that's going to change the most in the next 10 years is because of the smart contract.
Yeah, I was listening to a Tim Ferriss podcast this week, and he was talking to I forget his name, but he's the ex-CEO of Home Depot in the US, and he was a lawyer. He came up, he was a lawyer before he was a CEO, and he said, you know, the law industry, the legal industry, is one of those that's geared towards inefficiency. The whole purpose of a law firm is to be inefficient as possible, because the more inefficient you are, the more you charge the client. So, you know, and that I think is as an opportunity for blockchain to step in and go, well, actually the time for making, you know, ridiculous fees on repeating the same contract that you've done, you know, 200 times before, you know, maybe those times are over.
Yeah, exactly. There's, yeah, I've worked with some very good lawyers over the years, and then yeah, I've definitely worked with some ones that will sell you as many types of documents that they can convince you that you need. So, yeah.
talk to me. So just before we sort of get down towards the end of this chat, talk to me about GoSave, because it sounds like a really interesting prospect. And just sort of give us a quick pitch, the elevator pitch for that.
Yeah, thanks. So GoSave is, I guess, my third IoT company now. And the idea came about was So my son's 3.5 now, and I've just, he's got a little money box at home, and I've just been kind of teaching him a little bit about savings and trying to reward good behavior. And we had a star chart at home as well. So we had that up on the fridge, and we'd give him a star if he, you know, would brush his teeth and would go to bed on time. And so I'm really interested in the different ways and means to motivate kids, and to do it in a way that's age appropriate. And so the more I looked at it, I started to think, there wasn't really a good digital star chart or a good digital money box out there in the marketplace for kids and for parents. And the more I kind of, I liked that as an idea. And sorry, this is not an elevator pitch at all anymore.
It's a very long ride.
It's more of a rambling anecdote.
We're going up a long tall building, but no, keep going.
Yeah. I know, I used to run an accelerator, and I can't do a 60-second pitch.
It's terrible.
So I started researching more and more about how bad as adults we are ourselves at saving. Until I was about 30, was a particularly good saver. And the stats in the US are horrendous. It's something like 47% of US adults have less than $400 in savings.
So many people live paycheck to paycheck in the US. I think, you know, just as many live in Australia as well. But it's horrific. And I'll be honest, I was terrible. I was shocking at controlling money. And it's something I've become much, much, much better at in the last sort of two years. But yeah, I wish I'd had something like that when I was younger.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And that's how I feel as well. I was kind of, grew up in a really middle-class household. Dad's a lecturer, mum's a physio, you know, both really smart people. But now the middle class, we don't really talk about money at home or around the dinner table. And entrepreneurs do, and investors do. But and so if you grow up in that type of environment, you move out of home and then you get a credit card, and it's kind of baptism of fire stuff. Your financial literacy is really poor. So I'm kind of thinking, yeah, I really want to make this product that obviously gets people in the habit of saving early, because, if you save on average $5 a day from when a kid's born to when they're 18, that's $32,500 without any interest or compounding or anything, or even investments. So just the habit of regular savings and small amounts is pretty powerful. So I'm kind of thinking GoSave can help help parents teach kids how to save. And I don't even think I explained what it is.
I was going to suggest is that you tell us what sort of age group is it targeted?
Yeah, sure. So they are, they actually are digital money boxes. So right, we have three of them. We have a pig, we have an astronaut, and we have a unicorn. And they have a little kind of 4.5-inch screen in them. The parents have an app, so the parents transfer onto the device. And it's age from kind of kids age 3 to about 12.
Right.
Is kind of the primary target market. And a lot of research says that kids learn, obviously, from their parents' financial habits, but a lot of their savings habits are set by age 7. And there's a big Cambridge study on that. In the late 90s. So I'm kind of, want our products to be like a visual representation of savings that are cute and fun, and kids, you know, under 7 can learn how to save. And as they get a little bit older, they can continue to save. And you can do things like delegate chores onto the device as well. So I can say to I can put a notification to my son, Dad wants you to clean your room for $2. That pops up on his toy. He gets a notification of that, and he can click done. I get a notification on my phone to click verify, and the money goes into his account. So it's this whole kind of little savings, chore management, reward system in the form of a money box.
You're going to turn thousands of kids into sort of mini hustlers who are going to be looking for more chores and looking for more jobs around the house in order to pick up another dollar and $2 here.
Yeah, I know. It's funny. When you look at the research around pocket money and allowances, the US call them, that there's two distinct schools of thought that's like, no, kids should not get money for doing their chores. That should be something they innately do. And then another big camp of research says, no, it's important to tie financial literacy to effort and reward, blah, blah, blah. We've kind of smack bang in the middle of that. We will have stars as well. So if you're the type of parent that's like, no, you know, I don't want to, you know, I don't not exactly that. I don't want my kid to kind of be too money orientated, and that could be a real thing. You can allocate them, say, a star for doing a particular chore, and then eventually they get 5 stars. They get a reward that you and the child have kind of determined together. Yeah. So, we want to be able to cater to both sets of the market, but we do want to encourage parents that saving is important, and you don't have to tie it to chores, but you should be saving a small and regular amount for the kids as they grow up.
Where can people go and buy one of those if they want to go and buy one?
Good question. So we're just about to launch on Kickstarter.
Right, okay.
Yeah, I actually submitted today. So I think it takes 3 or 4 days to get approved, cool. Assuming that all goes through. Right. And so hopefully we launch early next week.
My final 3 questions. Number one, what are some of the brands out there that you admire? Is there something that you sort of buy all the time that you look at all the time? I mean, you talked about you being a brand person earlier on. What brands attract you?
Yeah, I've always loved the Virgin Group. It's an obvious one, but just Branson's is such a great living brand in and of himself, and then the companies that he's created over the years. It is just that fun and irreverent challenger brand, and I've just always identified really well with that brand. I think he does a really good job of kind of going in being the underdog in every market, and you can't help but barrack for him. Or at least I can't. So I've always been a massive admirer of Virgin. I particularly like a brand in the US that I've been following in the last few years called Shinola. I don't know if you've seen those guys.
How would you spell that?
Shinola. So it's Shinola.
Okay.
And they're a Detroit-based, they started as a watch company, and now they've kind of become this fashion and lifestyle company. But they got started, obviously, when Detroit, when all the automakers started moving out and went bankrupt in 2007, 2008, kind of just around the GFC. And Shinola positioned themselves as, we're rebooting Detroit, where these watches are made in Detroit. And they hire a bunch of people who used to be mechanical engineers at Ford and wherever else and retrain them as watchmakers. And they're diversifying into bikes and clothes and leather goods and all this other stuff. And they're up over they're even doing a hotel now in the US.
Wow.
So, and they're up over $100 million in revenue. So it's just been a fascinating journey to watch them because they've, in the space of less than 10 years, they've created this really powerful and quite meaningful brand in a short period of time. So
it looks stunning for anyone that's wants to go and have a look. I think it looks a beautiful brand actually.
Yeah, I think they've done a cracking job and just such a great story behind it. And then I really like brands that have a bit of a social good to them as well. So I really admire kind of social entrepreneurs, but I've never played in that space myself. But a brand that I've been following over the last few years, they're not particularly well known, but I think eventually they will be, is BioLite. So they make these camp stoves, and about something like 2 billion people still cook on wood fire stoves every night in their homes. And then millions of people obviously get really sick from carbon dioxide poisoning and carbon monoxide poisoning as well through these by cooking with fire in their homes in the developing world. So BioLite, they created kind of these basically safe, I can't remember if they're kerosene or wood, and they just extract it differently. I can't remember exactly how they work, but they created these safe cooktops that people in the developing world can use, and they sell it in camping stores all around the Western world, and then they massively subsidize it and almost give it out in the developing world. And so they're really tackling this problem head on and having some really good inroads with, they're getting quite widely adopted in developing worlds. So
I think
I really like products that can do that and brands that can do that.
I was going to say, looking at both these brands, the BioLite and the Shinola, it's evident that design inspiration for you is something that attracts you, because these look like beautifully designed brands. They're from a they're from the heart of some product manager who's sort of designed this and really spent a lot of time doing that.
Yeah, totally. It's that really nice intersection of kind of the craftsmanship about building that brand and the brand story, and then going out and living those values. So like, oh, actually, Patagonia is another great example. Like, just such a beautiful brand in and of itself, but then they're really socially active and aware, and they kind of go out there and stick the middle finger after the establishment and say, you know, you shouldn't be cutting down these forests, and they do a whole bunch of really interesting stuff. So, yeah, I do like brands that kind of that combine that artistry with that integrity of kind of getting out there and hopefully making a dint in the world.
What's second to last question? What's next for you? I mean, obviously, you've got a lot to, you've got a lot of money boxes to sell on Kickstarter. What else have you got in the pipeline? Anything that we can know about?
So I'm working with a handful of clients that are building different things at the moment. One of them is building a really, really interesting robot for kids. So I don't know if you've seen Jibo, which is a robot that was launched in the US last year, I think late last year. And it was ended up being on the cover of Time magazine. So his personal robotics is going to be a really interesting market in the next 10 years. And yeah, it just so happens there's a team in Melbourne building a really awesome kind of robot for kids.
I did. I saw Jeff Bezos taking the robot dog for a walk. Did you?
Yeah.
Which scares the living shit out of me because, you know, all we need is for those dogs. There's a Black Mirror episode with robot dogs in it. I don't know if you've watched any Black Mirror.
I have, but I haven't seen that episode.
Okay, watch that, then go and watch Jeff Bezos walk that dog, and then tell me that that's not the end of humanity right there, because I can't see. Once the artificial intelligence and robot dogs meet head on, that is the end of us. So, yes, that scares me. Final question. If anybody wants to find you, they want to talk to you, they want to ask you a question, for God's sake, don't put your number on here, but where can they get hold of you?
So the consulting company is mosaiciot.com, which is our kind of a generic, it's kind of consulting, but it's also my product development company. So it's kind of my umbrella brand where I develop my own ideas and then help other people with their ideas. So, yeah, that's that. Based up here in Brisbane. We're actually in little Tokyo too.
Capital building. Yes, yeah.
Yeah, so we're up on level 4 there. And GoSave is probably going to be my major project in the next few years. So with any luck, I think we'll get an opportunity to build a really big business in that space. So, that's gosavehq.com is the website there. And, I think Kickstarter, it should be able to find it on there in the next kind of week or so.
Cool. Wonderful. Thank you very much for your time, Andrew. It's been an absolute pleasure. So many ideas. It's fantastic to hear your the thought pattern that you go through with these kind of things. I think there's a lot of entrepreneurs out there, there's a lot of business owners who have the same sort of challenges. We've often referred to on this show as entrepreneurial ADHD, that, you know, one minute you're doing one thing, the next minute you see something else. It's that, oh, look, there's a dog. it's very dangerous. And a quote I always use is about, and do you know, I can never remember who this quote is attributed to, but it goes something like, the best way to make a lot of money is to have a really, really good idea and then never have another one.
Yeah, it's very true. It's a good balance to be able to try.
Yeah, but mate, once again, thank you very much for your time. Really appreciate you coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks very much, Simon.
That pretty much wraps it up for me this week. That was episode 21. Really appreciate you tuning in. Once again, if you get a chance to rate and review us on iTunes, that is fantastic, and we do really appreciate that. Otherwise, please feel free to drop me a line, come and find me on LinkedIn, or email me on simon@simondell.com. Otherwise, I will see you all next week. Thank you.